Well, thanks for letting me come and talk a bit about my research. This is a picture of me and my daughter, Aishna, collecting, I think that's a true morphologist or a systematist to name your daughter after a dragonfly. So I'm actually, my husband and I, we're both dual citizens, and I did most of my, I did my undergraduate degree at UBC in Vancouver, and if anybody's ever been there, it's this amazing, beautiful campus that's on this peninsula that juts out into the ocean, and it's actually really hard to get any work done because there's a clothing optional beach there and views of the mountain, and, you know, when I first moved there from Toronto, you know, I don't know that I was very productive, but eventually I kind of settled down and got some work done, and I had to work my way through school, so my first job was to do pinning for G.F. Scudder. They have a small, well now defunct, museum at UBC. Later on I went to work with Judy Myers, looking at BT resistance in cabbage sleeper populations in greenhouses, and also on NP virus in western tank caterpillars. And then there was this woman, Diane Srivastava, who was looking for someone who would smush up damselfly poo and try and figure out what they ate. And I thought that sounded like a pretty good job, you know? You have to pay the rent. So I ended up becoming her lab assistant and later her field assistant, working with these guys, Mrs. DeGaster and Modesta. And I went to Costa Rica with her a couple of times. And after that, I moved to New Jersey. And it's pretty different, I would say, in terms of habitat from Vancouver. You know, you see a lot more of this and a lot more of this. And well, luckily there's no more clothing optional beaches, but it's very different, you know. But we got used to it, and I got to work with a great group of people. My main advisor was Mike May, who's a big dragonfly specialist, but I also worked with Carl Chair, George Hamilton, and Mark McPeak. And I really liked doing my project because I got a chance to collaborate with a lot of people from various places shown here. So the main thrust of my PhD work was to look at dragonflies. And I worked on the Libellulordia. So there's about 9 or so families of dragonflies, and the group I worked on are these here, the spiketails, river cruisers, emeralds, and skimmers. And I used morphology and molecular data to try and tease apart these phylogenetic relationships. And it was really fun to do this project because I had to do some field work, you know, that's what systematists do. So I got to go to Australia, but unfortunately I was 6 months pregnant and it's really hard to catch dragonflies anyways. But when you've got this like low body of this parasite right here, it's hard to kind of jump around and get dragonflies, but I tried my best and got some stuff. And I also went to Namibia later on in 2007. And the main kind of conclusions I got from my research was previously there had been anywhere between 1 and 13 families that had been suggested for this group, and we found 4 taxonomic groups instead. They were the main players, Macromyidae, Corduliidae, and Libellulidae. And then this kind of strange group of, a lot of these are Australian endemics, which we're calling Sensunovum the Synthemistidae. And this had been found by a couple of other people as well. And one of the reasons why there was so much difficulty in terms of using morphology and kind of figuring out the number of families and subfamilies in dragonflies has to do with homoplasy. There's a lot of homoplasy in the morphological data sets. And so this led me to do a small side project with my advisor, with Mike, looking at flight behavior, because some of the wing venational patterns in dragonflies, some people had suggested, might be related to flight behavior. Some dragonflies are so-called flyers, where they spend most of their time on the wing. And other dragonflies are so-called perchers, where they spend a lot of time perching, do small patrols around a body of water and land on vegetation or on the ground with repeated takeoff and landings. And so you can imagine there's different venation patterns that might decrease energy expenditure or might facilitate flight. So we looked at that. And that led me to do a dad kind of internship at the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart this past March, looking at wing stiffness in dragonflies with Stas Gorb. And the Max Planck Institute is got a really great kind of bio group there that look at, you know, the pads, the sticky pads on the feet of geckos to try and make better adhesives for your scotch tape and things like that. So they it's a pretty good group to work with. I didn't want to just work on dragonflies because there's not that many people that want to hire someone who just works on dragonflies. So I tried to do some other methodological work as part of my thesis stuff. And so I looked at outgroup selection in the Dictyoptera as one of my side projects with Klaus Klass, Lauren Spearman, and Jesse Littman. And it really started out, we just kind of wanted to do a phylogeny of Dictyoptera because we were interested in them. But as it turns out, depending on whether we used closely related outgroups or closely and distantly related outgroups, we got different tree topologies, which led us to kind of using molecular and morphological data, try and explore this a bit further. So the basic story is that when we used closely related outgroups like Mantophasmatodeans, Grilloblattids, Embiopterans, as well as either dragonflies or locusts or Plecopterans, then we got, you know, cockroaches being sister to termites, which is kind of what you might expect. It's one of the more commonly accepted hypotheses these days. But when we just used closely related outgroups, we had the Blaboridea being sister to mantids, the Blattidae being sister to Isoptera, and the Polyphagoidea being sister to the rest of the Dictyoptera. And we couldn't really give a final statement about what the true tree of Dictyoptera was based on this work, but we kind of just advocated to, you know, caution when you're doing outgroup selection for this group. I also looked at parasites model and divergence estimation. And this is something that's kind of interesting to me because unpaired sites models are models of evolution that they kind of assume that each of the nucleotides in ribosomal data sets are independent. And paired sites models, like the RNA-7A model, they take into account the interdependence of hydrogen-bonded stem sites in the secondary structure of the ribosome. And so Carl Chair and Simon Ho and I, we did a small project where we looked at whether or not the divergence estimates that you would get for the nodes of your tree would be different whether you used a paired sites model or an unpaired sites model. And this is interesting, especially if you're working on something where you're looking at character evolution. And in dragonflies, I was really interested in looking at the evolution of exophytic oviposition. And depending on what dates you get, you might develop various hypotheses based on this. So most dragonflies do endophytic oviposition, but the Libelluloidea and the second most speciose group, the Gomphidae, they both have reduced ovipositors. And they can just kind of tap their abdomens on the water and disperse their eggs that way. And so that's something that a lot of people are really interested in figuring out why and how this evolved, and importantly, when this evolved. And so we kind of used that as a model for this paper. When we used an unpaired sites model on this dragonfly data set, we ended up getting an estimate for the root of the tree that was around 250 million years old. And when we used a paired sites model, we ended up getting a root of the tree that was around 50 million years younger. And we argued that the hypothesis that you might use to try and explain the evolution of exophytic oviposition would differ depending on which date you got. So it's actually pretty important to kind of, when you're doing these types of studies, to really be clear about how your model is affecting your dates and how that's affecting your ecological hand-waving that you're doing in your papers. So if you had a date for the root of the tree that was 250 million years, that was the time when there was one large continental landmass, really hot, dry climate, and you might be more prone to favor the hypothesis that this behavior kind of evolved because there wasn't very much water and you could exploit temporary or transient water sources that don't require plant material. Well, 50 million years late, if you were looking at a date that was 50 million years younger, that was kind of around the rise of vertebrate predators, where you have neobatrachid frogs and modern birds, which are both imposing a really strong predation threat on dragonflies, and exophytic oviposition is much faster, because a female just kind of taps her abdomen on the water and keeps on going. So you might be more prone to favor that hypothesis. So the main kind of conclusions of this paper was just to say that we don't know which of these dates is right, but it might be more prudent to use a more biologically realistic model, like a paired sites model for ribosomal data, when you're doing divergence estimation. Another project that I worked on had to do with conservation. Sometimes it's tricky when you're doing systematics, you're doing all this ivory tower stuff, you're not going to cure cancer, but you want to do something to give back. And so I was asked to work with Mike Samways and John Samaika from South Africa because they had a real problem where they had an endemic South African dragonfly, Cincordulia, and they were trying to get it protected because it was on the IUCN threatened list. It's really sensitive to alien plants like Australian acacia, eucalyptus, and pine. And they did these removal experiments where when they removed these plants, the dragonfly did a lot better. And they were trying to do something with the government to set up some conservation measures. But they needed to prove that they had four species instead of what was previously recognized as just being two species in this genus. So I helped them with kind of a biogeographical and molecular phylogeny. We had a really great RAU student that worked in our lab, and I collaborated with him on a phylogeny of Salithemis, which are the pennant dragonflies, and that was a pretty fun project. And right now I'm working with Camilla Koch on a project on the evolution of ovarial morphology in dragonflies. And as it turns out, it's actually a pretty cool story because in the Libellulidae, which is one of the families in the Libelluloidae, some dragonflies produce eggs all the time and they're always ready to lay eggs. And other dragonflies produce eggs in batches and then they actually have to leave the oviposition site and go to a feeding site and rest and wait for their eggs to mature before they can go back and start ovipositing. So we're looking at how and when this evolved and maybe why. A few years ago, there's somebody from Bulgaria, Milan Marinov, who thought maybe he had discovered a new genus of dragonfly. And a lot of people were really skeptical because what are the chances of finding a new genus of dragonfly just in Bulgaria? But he was sure that it was probably a new genus. And so he and I worked on a phylogeny of the entire Corduliini to try and figure out whether or not it was a new genus. And the molecular data says it probably isn't, but it still was a pretty fun project. And right now I'm working with Dave Grimaldi at the American Museum looking at termites, and it's a pretty different group from dragonflies, but still equally fun, and Dave's a pretty great guy to work with. And I also have the opportunity to collaborate with Terry Irwin at the Smithsonian on the Encyclopedia of Life project, and Jerry Luton is there, Ollie Flint, and my friend CJ, so it's actually a pretty great project to collaborate on for dragonflies. So I should thank all of the funding sources I've had, and thank you very much for the award. Do I have to take questions, or should I just go? I don't know if I should take any questions, or I talked pretty...
You may take them.
Okay.
When do you sleep?
Well, I have two young babies. I have a four-month-old and a three-and-a-half-year-old, so I actually never sleep because, you know, when one of them's asleep, the other one's awake. We have, like, some type of strange system where if one of them's awake, the other one sleeps and vice versa, so. But I have a great husband who's pretty supportive, and he's home watching them right now, and hopefully everybody's alive and the house is in the ruins, so we'll see when I get back. Thank you.
Thanks again, Jennifer.
Thank you again, Jessica. It is now my pleasure to introduce this year's winner of the Thomas Say Award, Dr. Stephen Marshall. Of course, as you know, the Thomas Say Award is given for significant and outstanding work in the fields of insect systematics, morphology, and or evolution. Dr. Marshall is a professor at the University of Guelph, where he's in charge of not only the insect collection, but of teaching several courses in insect biosystematics, field entomology, insect biology and diversity, to name a couple, or a few rather. His research is primarily associated with acalypterate diptera, but he's, of course, very well diversified himself. He is recently very well known for his 2006 book, Insects, Their Natural History and Diversity, which actually features some of his really outstanding photography. I think something like, 4,000 of his own photographs? Of course, he is also a founding editor and regular contributor to the Canadian Journal of Arthropod Identification. So, thanks for the shout out. Without further ado, Dr. Stephen Marshall.